Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
So good to have you with us on this Monday morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. It was a rough one for those of us that are Dodger fans, seeing LA down 2-0 in the best of seven series, which resumes at Dodger Stadium tomorrow late afternoon. The triple play will be on tomorrow to preview game three of the National League Championship Series. But we turn our attention right now to the very latest on COVID-19. We're so pleased to have with us again from UC San Francisco Medical Center, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at UCSF, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Dr. Chin Hong, welcome back. Great to have you with us today. And we certainly send our condolences on the Giants' loss.
I knew you were going to bring that up, Larry. Yeah. I was cringing at the thought, but I'm still wearing orange, and such a good morning to you also.
Well, I understand. I have a number of family members who live in the Bay Area and are huge Giant fans, and we haven't quite talked yet. So I'm sure we'll get to the point where the pain is a bit less and we resume our baseball conversations.
Yes.
But let's start first. We're going to talk a little bit later today about the passing of Colin Powell, former Secretary of State. But we do want to mention that he died at the age of 84 at Walter Reed Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, of complications of COVID-19. But he had been battling the cancer multiple myeloma. CBS News reporting he also had Parkinson's. I have not seen that from other news entities, but certainly multiple myeloma has been confirmed by Colin Powell's aide. So, Dr. BCH, how does that form of cancer potentially make a person who's even fully vaccinated like Powell more vulnerable to COVID?
Yeah, so it's Colin Powell is the kind of person, unfortunately, who not only can get breakthrough infections after being fully vaccinated, but can pass away. And he's following the demographic of those who do that. 2% of breakthrough infections actually die, but the median age is 82. They usually have some comorbidity, particularly immunocompromised state. So he had the confluence of being immunocompromised plus older age. So I think that really increases risk in the face of vaccination. How it happens? Well, we all have white cells that fight infection in the body. And in multiple myeloma, you have non-functioning white cells because they're malignant and they're multiplying. They crowd out the bone marrow. And we know that in people who get vaccinated, only about 50% of them respond to the vaccine. That's why even before boosters for immunocompromised individuals like people with multiple myeloma, and this is on one extreme, we had authorized a third shot, not calling it a booster. And some people might even need more. So that's basically how one can not do well after being fully vaccinated. It's not that you don't have a vaccine, so it's not really a breakthrough. I'm not even convinced that he might have had a response.
To the vaccine?
Yes, to the vaccine.
So you think it's possible. So it sounds like it could be a double whammy for someone in his health condition. You don't get a response from the regular dosage or dosages of the vaccine. And then when you get a breakthrough infection, you've got these underlying conditions which make it more difficult for the body to fight it off?
Yes, exactly. So when we think about Colin Powell, he's older. So even if he had a response, 2% of people who are old, older in that age range, the median age of 82, could die with breakthrough infections. And even if he weren't 82, if he just from having multiple myeloma, he may not have had a response from the vaccine. So he's, you know, essentially walking around like if he was non-vaccinated. And that's why he may have, people in that category would need an additional dose or more.
Well, and it's another good reminder of how the rest of us being vaccinated helps protect people like Colin Powell from getting COVID. At least that's our hope.
Exactly. We want to form that wall of immunity, the immunity bodyguards around the most vulnerable people in our community, people who might have even gotten vaccinated, but they might even have a low titer, so not a lot of antibodies produced or no antibodies produced. And if enough of us are vaccinated, it doesn't matter if they have a low titer or no antibodies, because we're going to protect them and the virus is going to bounce off the people in Colin Powell, not in this particular case, life.
Kitty in Monrovia emailed us, Colin Powell's death, in spite of being fully vaccinated, is making us vaccinated folks anxious. And she quotes you talking about how low the odds are that you're going to get COVID if you're a fully vaccinated person. So what would you say to Kitty and to others who, looking at the loss of Colin Powell, this raises their anxieties?
I wouldn't be more anxious. Again, Colin Powell was older and immunocompromised. So I think that by itself can, increase his chances, as we said, of not having a great outcome. But also, you know, again, in the hospital setting, even in people who are older with immunocompromising conditions, I haven't seen a lot of deaths. So this is really the exception rather than the rule. And, even though he's very, very prominent, we can't generalize his situation to the experience of most people, even if you're older and immunocompromised, as long as you've received the vaccine.
Now, CNN apparently is also now reporting that COVID Powell had Parkinson's disease. So is that a factor at all, Dr. Chin Hong? Would that have any effect on a person's immunoresponse?
Parkinson's disease by itself shouldn't have an effect on the immune response. Parkinson's disease and other neurological conditions are a risk factor for, you know, being hospitalized with COVID or getting COVID without vaccines in the first place. In fact, you know, they were folks, you know, in terms of a comorbidity, you can think of them in that way. And similarly in people with disabilities, because they can't clear their secretions that well. The virus can probably linger in that situation a lot easier. You can't sort of be as agile movement wise. So again, it's a confluence of things. Maybe Colin Powell may not have had an immune response, or maybe he had a mild immune response, but then, you know, his mobility is affected. So then it becomes easier to acquire infection from somebody in the community.
Again, coming up later this hour, we'll talk about the passing of Colin Powell at the age of 84. We'll talk about his legacy, and we'll take listener calls as they talk about Powell and what he represented for them. That coming up later this hour on Air Talk. Jay in San Diego emailed us at atcomments@kpcc.org. I'm wondering what the data shows for breakthrough cases in vaccinated people regarding the source of infection. Are most transmissions occurring from non-vaccinated to vaccinated people and fewer from vaccinated to vaccinated? Again, Jay is talking about breakthrough cases.
Oh, that's a great question from Jay. I think there's a variety, but most of the cases have been from people who are non-vaccinated because they're more likely to acquire infection in the first place. From the LA CDC data, we know that, you know, at least more than 10 times more likely to acquire infection. So the probability is high that a vaccinated person will get it. And once they get it, even though the viral load is similar in a vaccinated and non-vaccinated person who's infected, the decline of virus is much faster in a vaccinated person. So they are less infectious for fewer days. So I think with all of those factors, most people who get breakthrough infection, vaccinated or not, well, vaccinated in this case, get it from people who are unvaccinated. So the higher the proportion of people who are unvaccinated in the community, the higher these events occur.
We're talking with UC San Francisco's Dr. Peter Chin Hong. He's professor of medicine, infectious disease specialist, and he practices at UCSF Medical Center in San Francisco. We welcome your questions for him about COVID-19 and about vaccinations. We're at atcomments@kpecc.org for you to email us. Please include your location as well as your first name. You can also call us at 866-893-5722.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
In this nearly 2 years of pandemic, there have been some very dark, very difficult times. I know that some of our listeners have lost multiple family members, friends, and people close to them. And so we certainly grieve and acknowledge what a terrible time this has been for the world to go through this pandemic. One bright ray in that has been our opportunity to talk with people like Dr. Peter Chin Hong, who are so dedicated to what they do and willing to take so much time to talk with us about what we need to understand about COVID-19. And I've appreciated his distanced friendship as he joins us from San Francisco on a weekly basis, at least, if not more. And I know you do, too. And I just want to take this opportunity again to thank you, Dr. Chin Hong, for all that you're doing for us and helping to you know, give us some clarity here and ease our anxieties at the same time that we stay vigilant.
Thanks so much, Larry. And the benefit is definitely bi-directional. You know, I feel like my whole life has led up to this point where I can, you know, teach the community, and working with you and KPCC has really been one of the big highlights of the last 18 months for me. So thank you.
Thank you so much. We're taking your questions at atcomments@kpcc.org. Please include your location and your first name. You can also call us at 866-893-KPCC. If you prefer Twitter, tweet at AirTalk. And if your Facebook app is already open, you can ask us a question on the KPCC AirTalk Facebook page. John in Fullerton emailed us, "I'm immune compromised and I need periodic IVIG infusions. Does this provide protection from COVID-19?
That's a great question from John. A regular IVIG product would not protect you against COVID-19. You can get an enriched product, which is called essentially convalescent plasma. And you know, the most refined product for COVID now is the monoclonal antibodies, Regeneron, et cetera. They all do the same thing. If you think about regular IVIG, it's just a wide swath of people's immune cells. They may or may not have had COVID and they're not concentrated. Convalescent plasma is people who definitely had COVID, but they could be low titer or high titer, and monoclonal antibodies in the form of Regeneron that we've heard about, those are the most refined product. And so the short answer is not regular monoclonal, not regular IVIG will be able to protect you.
And IVIG again, what is that treatment?
So people get people's antibody therapy for a variety of different immune compromising conditions because you can't either make any antibodies on your own, or it helps you fight specific or non-specific infections. So in other words, if you don't have your own antibodies, you can't make them in time, and you get like a serious infection in the pre-COVID days. In some situations, we would not only give you an antiviral or an antibiotic, we would give you extra armies to help you fight the infection, which is in the form of IVIG. It can also be used as prevention. So for people who get a lot of specific infections, you can get it monthly or so to prevent you from getting sick and going to the hospital in the first place.
Z in Hawthorne emailed us, which vaccine has the least serious side effects?
That's a great question from Z. And I think it all depends on who you are. In general, the mRNA vaccines probably have the lowest side effect profile for a general person. The main ones are the severe allergic responses, one in a million or so. And with anaphylaxis, nobody has really died. That's why we wait 15 minutes in general, or 30 minutes if you've had a history. And then the other effect with mRNA vaccines, of course, is myocarditis, mainly seen, or inflammation of the heart, mainly seen in young adults. People generally do well. If you got one and you got myocarditis, we would not like to give you the second shot for mRNA, but you can get a J&J vaccine. And for J&J and AstraZeneca, the main side effects are that we worry about might be clots. But again, those are very low risk, very, you know, several per million. So not overall very, very safe vaccines.
If you look at the states where COVID rates are increasing, they are colder weather states in the winter: Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, Idaho. All of those are seeing there, and they're in the top 10 of increases, are seeing at least 67 cases per 100,000 people. And Alaska has 125 cases per 100,000 people. Vermont, Colorado, New Hampshire, Michigan, and Minnesota are seeing these increases. So this would seem to indicate that people spending more time indoors is increasing the risk of exposure to COVID-19. Do you anticipate in our milder California climate that we will see a weather-driven increase here or not?
I think weather is definitely a factor, but it's other factors that play come into place as well. For example, how much of a surge the particular community has had. So, you know, because New England in general has kind of escaped, particularly like Vermont, New Hampshire, much of bad COVID for the last year, they will probably be hit again because they don't have a lot of natural immunity, plus because it bolsters vaccine immunity. And I think politics also plays a role. So if you're gathering indoors and there isn't a mass culture, or people don't, and your level of virus is high in the community, you will definitely have a higher probability of transmission. Some policies in states like Montana, for example, are not quite as forgiving in terms of preventing people from getting infected when they do congregate in these risky situations.
Cliff in Carson City, Nevada, emailed us, I'm a smoker and my respiratory system is compromised. I'm 59 years old, so I'm not in the category approved for the Pfizer booster. When do you think I will be able to get a third shot?
That's a great question from Cliff. I mean, I think smokers, we know, have a 2 times higher risk of getting infected in general when you look at the literature. So even though it's not a formal criterion, because smoking is a behavior, it's not a disease per se, you know, maybe discussing with a healthcare professional might help you know, get that case for getting a booster shot. But in terms of the general population, we're not really sure yet. So far, we haven't really been seeing, and certainly borne by my own experience, a lot of vaccinated people having really bad outcomes if they are not older than 65 specifically.
Now, he doesn't say he has COPD, but he says his respiratory system is compromised.
Yeah.
Would that not be a case where you would almost certainly want to have a booster?
Yes. If I was Cliff, I would just go and, you know, because it's all on self-attestation when you go to Walgreens and CVS. He may have some, particularly if he has respiratory problems, you know, reactive airways disease, asthma, COPD might all be in the play. And I would be comfortable with him getting a booster shot.
All right. Linda in Pasadena says, my daughter's 25, fully vaccinated with Pfizer. She heard Moderna has more lasting effectiveness, and she now wants her booster to be Moderna instead of Pfizer. Would it actually be better for her to switch brands? She has no underlying health conditions.
So Linda is right. When you look at the data objectively, it seems that Moderna performs better than Pfizer, and Pfizer performs better than J&J without boosters. But the Moderna versus Pfizer situation is more complex because, first of all, Moderna had a higher dose. And then, but most importantly, I think Moderna was spaced at least 4 weeks apart from the first dose for the second versus 3 weeks apart in Pfizer. And most people believe that it's the duration that really was driving the better performance in Moderna and not anything else. And maybe it was the higher dose of vaccine. Nevertheless, the booster for Moderna is half the dose. And they're essentially the same vaccine. So I don't really, there's no biological reason why Moderna would perform better than Pfizer otherwise.
All right. Dr. Peter Chin Hong joining us on Air Talk, as he does at least weekly, talking about COVID-19. And of course, lately, most of our conversation has been around vaccines and our better understanding of them. Dr. Chin Hong, how far are we away from the CDC making its recommendations on Moderna and J&J boosters?
Well, the CDC is going to meet Thursday and Friday of this week, so we should have results soon. And again, it's been so dramatic because, again, after the CDC meets with the advisory board, ACIP, Dr. Rochelle Walensky has to then look at their recommendation and decide if to go with it or not go with it, as in the last case. So by the end of this week, we should have a formal answer, but I wouldn't expect any other but a positive. The only sort of drama is whether or not, or question, is whether or not people would mix and match. I think personally that it's fine to mix and match. And it seemed the data, at least with antibody response, seems very compelling with J&J followed by either Pfizer or Moderna.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your being with us, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Have a terrific week.
You too, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center. He's professor of medicine at UCSF and infectious disease specialist who's been with us for more than a year and a half on at least a weekly basis. Sometimes we've called on him more than once a week, and he's very happily obliged, which we're very appreciative of.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. And I would like to prompt you to action right now. No, not. I'm not asking right now for a financial contribution. There'll be time for that later. What I am asking you for is to share your memories and your thoughts of Colin Powell, who died at the age of 84 of complications from COVID-19. He was dealing with multiple myeloma and the seriousness of that cancer. He also, according to multiple reports, had Parkinson's disease. Colin Powell leaving us raises to the fore his extraordinary career, of course, 4 decades of public service. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about what Colin Powell represents to you at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-KPECC. You can also email your comments at atcomments@kpecc.org. Please include your location and first name. So in his 4 decades, Colin Powell was a diplomat. He was national security advisor. And of course, he's remembered for his 2003 speech at the United Nations Security Council, which helped pave the way for the U.S. war in Iraq. And he was a pathbreaker. He was the first Black national security advisor, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and first Black secretary of state. He was a son of Jamaican immigrants growing up in New York City, born in Harlem, went to City College of New York, and became interested in being a part of the Army when he was in the ROTC program at City College. And from there, of course, his Army career skyrocketed. And he had extraordinary responsibilities, of course, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He put together the plan for the invasion of Panama in 1989, directed the Persian Gulf War in 1991, and was a huge figure in American Cold War military policy. So again, I'd like to hear your thoughts about Colin Powell as a pathbreaker, someone who made history in many different roles that he had. There is, of course, and he talked about this himself, the presentation to the UN Security Council in 2003. Let's, in fact, go back and hear just a few seconds of that presentation.
What I can share with you, when combined with what all of us have learned over the years, is deeply troubling. What you will see is an accumulation of facts and disturbing patterns of behavior. The facts and Iraq's behavior demonstrate that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community. Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
And then he was asked by talk show host Larry King of CNN several years later about his reflections on that speech and the inaccuracies and false claims that he made in it.
The information that I was being given by the intelligence community hung together. And I spent 4 days and nights out at the CIA going over it and asking every way I could, are you sure of this? You have multiple sources on this. And I got those assurances. They're the same assurances that the intelligence community gave to the president, the same assurances the intelligence community gave to the Congress 4 months earlier at the request of the Congress. And the Congress passed a resolution supporting the president if he decided he had to take military action. That was months before I ever gave my UN speech.
But a lot of people counted on you.
I know.
You changed the ball.
I turned the dial. There's no question about it. And that's what the president wanted me to do and what I was supposed to do.
You regret it.
I regret it now because the information was wrong. Of course I do.
Let's take a listener call from Seth in Woodland Hills. You're on Air Talk. Seth, your thoughts about the passing of Colin Powell.
Yeah, it has to do with what we heard from Larry King. I have mixed feelings about this. Colin Powell, at one time, I thought of him as a great leader, and obviously he was from African American community, had achieved great heights in his career. But I think the the negative part of it is what it did to push forward the Iraq War, which was a completely baseless war and concocted, you know, by the of the Bush administration. And Colin Powell became sort of the respectable face of that war. And that's going to haunt his legacy. And I'm sad to say that, but it's true.
Seth, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Let's talk with Gia in Corona Del Mar. Good to have you with us on Air Talk as we remember Colin Powell.
I just wanted to say that I hope his legacy includes his hope, I mean, his support for early childhood education. I have an aunt who was a veteran Head Start teacher in a small town in Pennsylvania, and he found out that she started this adopt-a-grandparent program where she paired these preschoolers with retired people while their parents worked after school. He contacted her and asked if she would star in a national commercial put out by his foundation to try to inspire more people to support early childhood education. And I just think he didn't always get credit for things like that, you know?
I thank you so much, Gia, for telling us about that. That's fascinating to hear. Thank you so much, Gia, in Corona Del Mar, 866-893-KPECC. You can email us. Please include your location and first name at atcomments@kpecc.org. Demos in Inglewood said, I had tremendous respect for Colin Powell. He was one of those people I didn't understand being a Republican. I'm black, and I have a difficult time understanding why he supported their platform. Dima says, you might be aware, in later years, he left the Republican Party. You know, he supported Barack Obama for president, and he did not support, you know, John McCain in his presidential candidacy. And he was highly, highly critical of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. He was a frequent critic of former President Trump as well. So he certainly was a Republican, of course, and served in Republican administrations. He was talked about as a potential Republican presidential nominee so many times. It seemed we were getting close to where he might make an announcement about running, and then, of course, that never happened. But later on, he became disillusioned with his party and definitely separated himself from the GOP. In remembering Colin Powell, current Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin talked about the supportive words and conversations that he had with the late former Secretary of State.
The world lost one of the greatest leaders that we have ever witnessed. Alma lost a great husband, and the family lost a tremendous father. And I lost a tremendous personal friend and mentor. He has been my mentor for a number of years. He always made time for me, and I could always go to him with tough issues. He always had great counsel. We will certainly miss him. I feel as if I have a hole in my heart.
I saw him on television this morning making the comments, and you could just see the deep emotion and grief that that Lloyd Austin was experiencing as a result of that, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Sharon tweets at AirTalk, I didn't always agree with Colin Powell. In fact, we often were wildly apart, but I always respected him, a true public servant, one of the last on the GOP side. That Sharon writing on Twitter. Let's see, Romano in Rancho Cucamonga, I had tremendous respect for him until he gave that UN speech. I was very disappointed, but over the last few years, he really redeemed himself in my eyes. That's Romano in Rancho Cucamonga. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, one of our very popular backbone segments where we talk with two of my KPECC colleagues about the work that they do serving you as a listener of KPECC. That's coming up later this hour, but we begin with KPCC's John Horn, who's been immersed for these past days looking at the potential for a strike that would have started today involving Hollywood crews working on TV and film productions. The good news for the industry is that a tentative deal has been reached between IATSE, the union representing those crew members, and the Producers Association. John joins me from a studio across the hall because if he was in Studio A with me, we'd both have to wear... We don't want to do that.
We don't.
So, John, first of all, you surprised that they were able to reach a deal because it seemed like, you know, once the union announced late last week that they'd strike starting Monday, there wasn't a lot of time to reach a deal.
No, there wasn't. But they have been negotiating for nearly half a year. And IATSE came into these negotiations with, you know, a fair amount of power, at least over the last couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago today, they released the results of a strike authorization vote where more than 99% of the ballots cast were in favor of letting the IATSE negotiators call for a strike if one was needed. Now, you have to put this in some sort of historical context. IATSE, which has about 60,000 members, people like costume designers, editors, hair and makeup people, they haven't called for a national strike authorization in their 128-year history. So this is a bold statement for this guild. And then they set this deadline that was 12:01 this morning, midnight Sunday, early this morning, however you want to divide it. And they had that ticking clock, and they have the support of other Hollywood guilds. If IATSE had gone on strike, probably no other guild was going to cross their picket line. So it was going to be a total and complete shutdown of all production, not just in Hollywood, but across the country. And they struck a deal. Now that the deal, like small details of the deal are coming out, people are starting to step back and wonder if IATSE got all that it might have gotten.
So it obviously still has to be ratified by the membership, and typically that's pro forma when you get these tentative deals that are struck by the negotiators. In this case, are you hearing anything about the details coming out that leads you to think if this could be a close call?
Well, some are coming out, and what typically happens in a period like this is they being the negotiators for IATSE and the studios, which are represented by an entity called the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, or the AMPTP, they kind of agree on, you know, back of the envelope terms. And then the lawyers have to go through it and memorialize it in a collective bargaining agreement. And then they have to kind of put that into some sort of verbiage that members can understand. So there's a process of, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's, and then they present it to the members. So at first glance, IATSE got a lot of things that were very important. At closer glance, people are now starting to react to turnaround time. It used to be as short as, you know, 9 hours for some people. If you went off work at 11 p.m. and you had an hour drive home, you basically had to get up at 6 the next morning to get back to the job. So that they expanded that. But I think what you're seeing on social media is people reacted favorably, and now they're taking a step back. Adam McKay, who's a filmmaker who's written a lot and made a lot of movies about labor and money. He directed The Big Short, wrote a tweet this morning congratulating IATSE. He took it down, and this is his new tweet. I deleted my tweet congratulating IATSE on their new deal. I posted it an hour after the news broke, and I'm now aware there were concessions that weren't so great. Yet another example of the golden rule, take a beat before reacting.
What is the timeline for members to vote on this?
They are saying it probably will be a couple of weeks. And I think what's going to happen in the interim is that as, you know, details of the deal become more public, you know, there's going to be more conversation around that. There were a lot of gains that IATSE achieved, and, you know, the studios are not going to give up easily. So I'm sure there was some, you know, good give and take, and any negotiation, if both sides are a little bit unhappy, it has been successful, because that's the whole point of a negotiation. You give up some and you take some. So I think what's going to happen is details are going to trickle out, and it'll be a question of whether or not those people who are unhappy with a deal are unhappy enough to convince a majority of IATSE members to vote against it. But, you know, if they vote against it, they'll be out of work and it will be a strike and they'll have to probably go back to the bargaining table and start not from scratch, but start all over again. So it would be a massive disruption. But that was the card that the IOTC negotiators held.
All right. I'd love to hear from members of IOTC if you want to weigh in on any of the details that have come out. If you're a producer and you want to weigh in on this, we're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also contact us at atcomments@kpecc.org. Please include your location and your first name. John, on the turnaround, which has been, you know, decried as being way too tight, as you were saying, and a safety concern for crew members having to make long drives, then come around, you know, just hours later to come back to work. Did they get anything comparable to what SAG, for example, gets for actors on turnarounds?
No. I mean, actors generally have what is called a daily rest period of about 12 hours. The IOTC negotiators were able to get that to 10. But let's talk about that math if you play it out in real time. So let's say you end work at 11 o'clock. You're working really late at night, and you have an hour drive home. A lot of people who work in IOTC have long commutes because they don't make a lot of money, and they can't live in Beverly Hills or Hollywood. So you're off work at 11. You get home at midnight, you know, say you're not going to say hi to your kids because they're sound asleep. Maybe your partner's up. You kind of wind down, get a bite to eat. Let's say you go to bed at, you know, 1 in the morning. So with that 10-hour turnaround, you left work at 11. You have to be back at 10 in the morning. So you get to sleep at, you know, say 2 in the morning. You got to get up at 8. So that's 6 hours of sleep. You got to eat something and drive back to work. And you're doing that every day for weeks on end. And that is what the, you know, the guild was really unhappy about. There's also this term called fratter day, which used to mean that you would work past midnight on Friday into Saturday, and you'd be due back at work on Monday morning. Now, that is something that IOTC did get some give back on. But if you were working fratter days, which was, you know, very often the case before this contract, you wouldn't have a weekend. I mean, you would basically get home Saturday morning at 2 in the morning. Maybe you were crashed all day, and then you'd have maybe half the day Saturday and Sunday, and then you're back at work. So those are some of the things that IOTC got.
What about improved compensation for streaming? Because this was something where the old contract, according to IOTC membership, didn't adequately compensate them.
Yeah, and we haven't seen those numbers yet, but there have been in the past reduced contract terms for streamers. And we got to say, they don't really need a break these days. I mean, they are making, you know, a lot of money. In the most recent quarter, Netflix reported, I think, $1.4 billion in income. Disney, that is banking a lot of money on Disney Plus, its streaming service, made about as much money in its last quarter. So they feel, and this is where this, you know, this story, I think, is the macro of this story is, the rank and file people in Hollywood have worked very hard at very low wages for a very long time. And we think of Hollywood as, you know, a lot of people who are rich and, you know, driving fancy cars and flying in private jets. That's what the studio bosses are doing. The rank and file people aren't, before this, making a living wage, you know, and they're having to work long hours. If you're a single parent, imagine what it's like. You're gone 16 hours a day. You're getting maybe $16, $17 an hour. This is about a growing and accelerating gap between the haves and have-nots. And I think IOTC felt they have done a lot of hard work to make sure that the studio heads of the world make a lot of money, and they're flying off in their private jets to their homes around the world, and people in IOTC are barely scraping by. So this is kind of a repositioning of how the rank and file in Hollywood are starting to say, we deserve a share of that.
I do want to ask you real quickly, we're almost out of time here, John, but there are other guilds with contracts that are expiring. I heard you on with Susanna Morning Edition, you know, talking about the writers who were you know, militant compared to IOTC members. And what do you think this sets up in future negotiations?
It could be really interesting. I mean, Hollywood works in what's a system called pattern bargaining. So contracts expire at certain intervals. And generally, the person who is negotiating the next contract looks at the last contract and says, I want that. So if IATSE gets one thing, SAG will want that. And then the Writers Guild will want that. And that's why the studios are so reluctant to give up anything to IATSE, because they can see it multiplying through the next series of contracts.
All right. Dan, who's a cameraman, member of IATSE, said at first glance he's planning to vote yes on the contract. He doesn't blame other members for wanting more, but he said he's going to vote based on what he saw of the first pass. It's Air Talk on KPCC. John, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
274 newly built units have sat empty for more than 60 days.
I'm Nick Gerda. In my news stories on homelessness, I follow the money, hold officials accountable, and tell you which policies are working, which are not, and how that affects people here in Southern California. I'm proud my reporting for LAist helped fast-track VA housing for veterans in West LA and forced an accounting of millions of taxpayer dollars in Orange County.
LAist. Independent journalism. Fact-based journalism.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Car insurance companies are using what's called telematics to learn what they can about their insurance driving practices and then price insurance policies accordingly. Now, this goes beyond just determining how many miles you drive in a year, but instead, by monitoring your car and your driving, determining the way that you drive and then what the likelihood is that you'll be in an accident for which they'll have to pay out on it. So the question is, you know, what you think about that. Is this something that you support? Is this technology, in fact, a fairer way of determining someone's propensity for getting in an accident? We're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also ask your question at atcomments@kpecc.org. With me is Douglas Heller from the Consumer Federation of America. He's an insurance authority. Douglas, thank you very much for being with us today. What are the ways in California that car insurers set their rates for their policyholders?
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. In California, we actually have some of the strongest consumer protections in the nation because several years ago, voters enacted something we call Proposition 103 that says that when insurance companies set our rates, they must be primarily based on how safely we drive and how many miles we drive. In other parts of the country, insurance companies use all sorts of things that have nothing to do with our driving, ranging from our credit history to how much education we have or whether or not we own our home. So we have some good protections in place here in California. But of course, we always want to see our driving, our insurance rates improve, but also our driving improve. And there is at least a theory that having a better understanding of how people drive when they're behind the wheel could create incentives to make our roads safer. And I think that's at least the best version of what this new telematics approach could offer.
What about where you reside? Is that used in California as a way of setting rates?
It is. And of course, that was one of the reasons back in 1988 that voters who were so upset with the high price of insurance, especially here in LA, enacted this Proposition 103 to reduce the amount of impact that our zip code would have on how much we pay for insurance. And so in California, we actually have rates that are much more moderated relative to where we live than around the country, but it still does have an impact and it can be significant. So that's, and that is unlikely to change, though We always want to see insurance companies focus more on how we drive rather than where we live or, you know, who we are.
Well, and is it clear that how someone drives can actually be measured safely? I mean, for example, there are certain things that a car isn't necessarily going to show telematically that you can see with the naked eye of how people drive. For example, someone who drives faster may not be a less safe driver than someone who drives very slow all the time. So is the analysis of the telematic information taken from the car sophisticated enough to process these nuances?
That's exactly the right question. And that's what the question that we as consumer advocates are asking regulators around the country and here in California, because in California, we actually aren't yet allowing insurance companies to use these kind of huge algorithms that process lots of data about how we drive, because we haven't actually seen that proof yet. And that's, I think, a most important question. Can these data gathering tools actually pick up whether or not we're driving safely? Now, the insurance companies argue that it can, but my view is that while it may be really helpful to have mechanisms for monitoring how safely we drive, we can't just let insurance companies track every turn we take and every place we go without guardrails in place. And those guardrails should require the insurance companies to be transparent about what data they're gathering when they sit shotgun with us.
And how they're analyzing it. Because that would be my concern before I would allow my insurer to do this, is I wouldn't just want to know what they're gathering, but then how do they weight it?
Well, but then also, and I think you're like a lot of Americans, because in fact, even though this telematics can be used in many other states more aggressively, a lot of people are just refusing it. And it's a slim minority of customers who have allowed insurance companies to get in the car with them because they just don't have that faith in this industry for good reason. And it's not just how are they accurately measuring our driving, but what are they doing with our personal data? Because some of these companies are tracking with their monitoring devices, tracking every location we go, every stop we make. And the question is, are they using it just to set our rates, or are they using it to, as one company's CEO said during an investor call, monetize all this data they're gathering? Are they using it to sell it just like Google does our data?
So just to clarify, they're overlaying GPS location information to what the car is doing?
Some of the companies are doing it with their practices, and that's the concern, and that's why I think in California we've been right to go slow about this. We
need
to establish the guardrails to make sure that insurance companies don't accumulate so much private and personal data about us that can be used against us, but also some of the other things they use. One thing a lot of them capture is the time of day we drive, and that may show some relationship to risk, but it also could really harm people who have to work a third shift and have that, you know, those night jobs because that's what's available to them. And that could really harm lower income workers.
Well, it could, but the other side of that is, Douglas, that is a riskier time to drive. That would represent a greater risk for the companies.
Yeah, and I think that what we want out of our insurance pricing is kind of a balance, because insurance isn't like any other product in the world, really. The government requires that we all buy it. So there's got to be some special rules in place to make sure that the insurance companies treat us fairly, but also that we actually can afford it. And if the people who have the jobs that pay the least money are the ones that are going to find themselves paying the highest price, then we're going to end up with uninsured motorists, which is even worse.
We're talking with Douglas Heller of the Consumer Federation of America, also with his president and CEO of the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies, Neil Aldrich. Neil, thank you very much for being with us. Is this something that you think is inevitable, that the telematics that monitor our driving are going to become ubiquitous?
Hi, Larry. Great to be with you. It definitely is a trend towards insurers using telematic data, but it's still in a sort of early stage, I would say. 215 million auto insurance buyers, people that are insured by auto insurance companies today in the country, only about 8 million of them have a telematics device or have signed up to participate in an insurer's telematics program. So it's something that is certainly proven to be a new adaption of technology, but there's a long way to go before it becomes, I would say, ubiquitous is the word you use.
And what role would California, do you think, ideally play in the evolution of telematics and regulations as to how the information's used?
Sure. So it's important to realize that every aspect of the insurance industry is regulated. The price that companies charge for auto insurance premiums, their financial solvency, the way they behave in the marketplace is all subject to rules and regulations and very heavily regulated industry. California, of course, is among the leaders in that. In California to date, there are some pilot programs that the Department of Insurance has approved for kind of small use of telematics data, but it's not at all something that is approved to use in a widespread fashion in California. Obviously, California is a highly populated state, a very large market from an insurance perspective. And so more adoption there could lead to more adoption in other places. California also happens to be the place where there's a lot of heavily dense driving that occurs. In Southern California, as you all well know, there's a lot of high density driving that occurs. And so you can see where perhaps telematics may play a role there.
And explain how this tracking is done. Is this a device that has to be plugged into the vehicle, or is it something that could be app-based on the phone? Does the phone have the capability to be able to record useful data for this?
Yeah, there's both ways. So there are some companies that have a device that plugs into your phone. Some of the very newest cars actually have telematic capability kind of programmed into their mechanics, into the car itself and the computer systems in the vehicle. So it'd be a matter of just accessing that data. And then others have an app that would be downloaded by a customer that would be tracking on their phone. All of those are sort of used today in the industry.
All right. We're talking with Neil Aldridge of the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies. I know that in some states, as Douglas Heller was telling us, that the credit scores and other things are used. Do you think this will become the dominant way of determining risk?
Well, at the end of the day, this does provide insight into how people are actually behaving behind the wheel. It's not a theoretical exercise. For instance, right now, students that get a B average or better typically get a discount, or younger males typically pay more than younger females do. But there are certainly good drivers that may not get a B grade in high school, or there are good drivers who are younger males and bad drivers who are younger females.
Yeah.
This kind of telematic data would be able to ferret out those differences and actually adjust people's prices to the actual relative risk that they represent, rather than just being in a group of people that may have similar characteristics based on their age or whatever the case
might
be.
Yeah, Neil and Douglas, thank you both very much for being with us and talking about the growing use of telematics by car insurance companies to track how drivers really perform in the world. Every day during our member drives, I look forward to highlighting the work of the members of our KPCC and LAist backbone team. These are the individuals who you're not typically going to hear on the air, but provide invaluable services in all that we do here at KPCC and making the experience for our listeners and our readers as compelling as possible. It's my pleasure to be joined by our Vice President of Community Engagement and Strategic Initiatives, Ashley Alvarado. Ashley, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it. I was looking at your KPCC bio. I can't believe you've been here 9 years.
Hi, Larry. Neither can I.
That's astonishing. So describe what your VP position encompasses.
Sure. So it's actually a brand new role, and it's really one that's focused on supporting our engaged journalism. It's a term that you hear more and more in the industry, but not so much in everyday. And so when we're talking about engaged journalism, we're really looking at how can we close the gap between community members and the journalists who are working to serve them. Here, that takes a lot of different forms. It includes overhauling our style guide so that we're making sure the word choices that folks hear on air or on our website are inclusive and welcoming. It's thinking about how we can do research first when designing a coverage area, so we make sure that we're thinking about the information needs and habits of those who need information, who are trying to navigate life here. And then it's also looking at how we can center different voices and perspectives in the work we're doing day in and day out.
And what is it that you find particularly rewarding about these different areas that you lead here?
Well, it's really, you know, it's one of those things where I am always terrified to be on air, but I'm excited to do it, to be able to talk about this kind of work. And so one thing that comes to mind immediately is our storytelling series, Unheard LA, where we're really inviting the voices and experiences of people that, you know, that make up Southern California, but don't always make up the lineup of news coverage or other conversations. So thinking about how we can hold that kind of space, something that, you know, I grew up, my sister and I are of mixed heritage, and we grew up in a town that was more than 92% white. And so growing up, I never saw pictures that looked like us or stories that sounded like our story. And so anytime I can be part of changing that experience for others and helping them feel seen and heard in the way that I so craved as a child, that's really special to me.
We're talking with KPCC Vice President of Community Engagement and Strategic Initiatives, Ashley Alvarado. Also with us is Brianna Lee, College Pathways Engagement Producer. Brianna, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Please describe your job.
Hi, Larry. I'm an engagement producer. I'm on Ashley's team, actually. So I'm one of the people who is also trying to bridge the gaps between our newsroom and the communities that we serve. I work on the College Pathways beat, which looks at the ways that people get to higher education and the obstacles that they face along the way. And right now we're looking a lot at adults who are trying to navigate their education and career choices. So for this job, I'm really just listening to the people who are thinking about higher education and asking them, you know, what information are you missing? You know, what do you want to know? What would be helpful for you? And seeing what we can do to find answers for them that will also be useful to people who are in a similar situation.
Now, you're, as I understand, a Bay Area native, right? So you're a native Californian, but what brought you to Southern California, to KPCC?
Oh, yeah. So after college, I spent 8 years in New York City for graduate school. And then my husband and I are actually both from California. His family's from Southern California and mine's from Northern. So we ended up moving down here just to be closer to our families. And so I actually started working at KPCC about 2 days after I moved to LA. It was a really good introduction to learning about LA.
And you had worked at public television in New York?
Yeah, my first job in journalism ever was at a local PBS station in New York, Channel 13.
All right, very good. What is it you particularly like about the work that you do? What's most rewarding?
So I think the thing that I get really excited about in journalism is trying to figure out how to make information directly useful to somebody's life. So if I work on anything and a reader tells me like, oh, you know, that was really helpful, like that's like the highest compliment to me. So a lot of my career has really been spent trying to figure out how to make the news more directly helpful on a larger scale. And one really big way to do that is to listen to community members about, you know, what's on their minds and just what they want to know. So, before the engagement producer job, I actually spent 4 years as KPCC social media editor. And that was a really great way to engage with our audiences on, you know, places like Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. And I essentially get to do the same thing as an engagement producer, but I get to do it more in depth and, you know, on the phone or in person. And we get to just talk much more deeply about some of the issues that people are facing.
So what's the best way for listeners who might have an idea for a story or something they're just curious about that they'd like us to investigate? How should they get it to your attention or any of your colleagues in this area?
Oh, I mean, on the website there, on basically every single story that we have on LAist, there is going to be something like a little form at the bottom of the story where you can submit a question or, you know, like some kind of insight or a way to talk directly to the reporter who wrote that story. So you can basically find it anywhere on any story, essentially on LAist.com. And you can also just find it on the homepage. There should be call outs there for, you know, do you have a question? Come and ask it to us.
Now, you were an international reporter before you did this work. Do you miss that at all, or you feel like you bring elements of that experience to what you do now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I spent a couple of years as a reporter on international affairs while I was in New York. And it was a lot. It was pretty stressful. I do miss aspects of it because, you know, I really love, you know, just like reading and writing about international affairs. But, you know, there's a saying about, you know, like you have to think globally and act locally. And I think since I've been at KPCC, like the importance of understanding your local landscape in order to be able to act locally has really hit home for me. So, while I miss aspects of what I was doing with international before, I see a definite like direct connection to what I was doing.
Oh, Brianna, that's great to hear. Brianna Lee, who's our College Pathways engagement producer, Ashley Alvarado, Vice President of Community Engagement and Strategic Initiatives. Ashley, tell us a little bit about what brought you to KPCC.
Sure. So it's actually not that different from what Brianna shared in that I was at the Center for Investigative Reporting, which was really doing and pioneering a lot of engaged journalism work, but it was at a national and international scale. And I was very, very hungry to see what it would look like if we were able to concentrate those area that effort in a defined geography. And Southern California is still huge, as we all know, especially when we're trying to figure out what freeway to get onto. But it allowed us to think about how we could be really intentional in a defined space. And so I came here. It's funny because I came here without a specific job title or a boss, but in the time that I've been here, have just loved getting to watch engaged journalism grow.
Ashley, thank you so much. It's just been terrific over the nearly decade that you've been here to see all the ways in which engagement has grown and what you and your team have worked on. It's absolutely extraordinary. And you mentioned you're a native Southern Californian, and so, you know, you've seen in your lifetime changes come. And one of the things exciting for me is just to see how KPCC and LAist are reflective of just the tremendous breadth of Southern California. Just every community is so distinct.
Oh, well, so I'm actually from Oregon, although I've been here for a very long time now. And it is true. I mean, one of the things that brought me to Southern California was that desire to get to be in a place where I didn't stand out for being, you know, for being the person of color in a room. And so it is really exciting to see that not only in the community I call home, but in the workplace I call home.
Ashley, thank you so much. Brianna, thank you again. Great to talk with both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. They're members of our backbone here at KPCC and LAist. Each day during our fall member drive, we have a chance to hear from a couple of them, talk about what they do, what brought them to KPCC, so you better understand all the great folks we have serving your interests here at KPCC.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.